right, welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, it is the beginning of year three of Piecing It Together. You heard the new theme right there. There's new artwork. There's all kinds of new stuff coming your way. Those are the first two big changes. But today we're going to be talking about The Invisible Man with a new guest co-host, Robert Yannis Jr. from the Crooked Table podcast. We have a great conversation coming up for you guys. The Invisible Man kind of, I wouldn't say it came out of nowhere, because I think a lot of people were really excited about it. And of course, there's a huge tradition with these Universal Monster movie characters, but not so successful recently. But this one is really blowing up at the box office, critics, everything. People are just really loving it. And so it's great to see them doing it right this time out. Not that The Mummy was really all that bad, but, you know, that's another conversation for another time. Today, the conversation is about The Invisible Man and year three of Piecing It Together. So, like I said, we got a lot of new things in store for you guys with this new year of the show. We're planning all kinds of special episodes and special new features and all kinds of cool stuff, but you should be subscribed to the show if you want to make sure you're always catching all that new stuff. So subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We're, of course, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, all those apps, Pocket Casts, where I listen to podcasts. And, of course, follow us on social media at Piecing Pod and join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we talk about all these movies and continue the conversation from here on the episode. So I think it's time to kick off this episode. So let's get into The Invisible Man. All right, so today on the show, we've got a new co-host with us. We've got Robert Yannis Jr. Robert, how's it going, man?
Good, David. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to having you on ever since I was on your show a while back, but I'm glad to have you. Why don't you tell people, since it's your first time, a little bit about you and your podcast?
Okay, so I'm a freelance writer, film critic, and I have the Crooked Table podcast, where every week we look at the world of film from a fresh angle. So that means it's always me and a different co-host. So, for example, David was on an episode talking about Wet Hot American Summer, yes, which people should definitely check out. Really fun movie that I actually hadn't seen before. And that's one of the best things for me about having a show where it's a revolving co-host and, you know, not really a set like limitation on the kinds of films that we get to talk about, is that 1 week we're talking about Parasite and the next week we're talking about, you know, La La Land. The next week I've done episodes on like Christmas in Connecticut and Psycho and like all kinds of like random, all different genres, all different, you know, because the people that come on the show, usually, as was the case with David, get it. They pick the movies that we talk about. So it's something that's usually connects to them personally. And I feel like, you know, I have a theory that it's, you really get to know somebody by knowing the kind of art that they're into, the kind of music they listen to, the kind of films that they connect with, because there's something fundamental about that that work of art, and in this case cinema, that I think speaks to someone on a very personal level, whether it's a Marvel movie or whatever. Like, there's something, you know, there's a connective tissue there that I think people either click with or they don't.
Totally. Yeah. And I totally agree. I mean, that's one of the things I love about doing this show is, you know, just having different people on all the time. You know, it brings different, you know, fresh perspectives and, you know, just something that I wouldn't be if it was just me and the same co-host every week.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I think you sacrifice a little bit of predictability with that, because obviously different co-hosts. So sometimes the tones of the episodes are a little different just based on the energy with between you and the co-host. But I you know, I think that's in a way what makes it fun as a host and hopefully as a listener to never know exactly what you're going to get or the kind of person you're going to hear from.
Exactly. So today we're talking about The Invisible Man, which is, of course, the, you know, probably thousandth time this story has been told over the history of cinema, since the old classic Universal Monster movie days to all kinds of remakes and reimaginings. And to this weekend's, this just came out, and it's getting great reviews. It's doing well with audiences. And I was pretty excited for it. When I put out a call for co-hosts for upcoming episodes, you jumped on this one. Are you a fan of the kind of history of this character?
I'm a casual fan of the Invisible Man. I saw we might talk about it later, so I won't mention the last like big modernization of the Invisible Man story. Uh-huh. But I was most curious because of the filmmaker involved, mm-hmm. Lee Whannell, who's the writer of like the first three Saws and like the creator of the Insidious franchise, and his last movie Upgrade before this was a really fun sort of like 80s style sci-fi horror, kind of in a way he's described as kind of his Frankenstein, actually.
Sure.
So I was curious to see what they were going to do with this property, especially after the struggle that Universal has had trying to get these characters off the ground once again.
Oh yeah. The Dark Universe, I'm sure, yes. We'll bring it up a couple times this conversation. I agree that that's part of what really piqued my interest as well, is to see, God, after crashing and burning, how are they going to move forward with trying to get back into the business of monster movies? And, Lee Whannell is an interesting filmmaker and definitely took a very unique and different and very current, direction for taking on this character. And I think it really paid off. But we'll get into a lot of that as we're going through this conversation. Why don't we jump into your first puzzle piece?
Well, this is actually the perfect segue because we kind of alluded to it already. I actually, for my first puzzle piece, I had The Mummy from 2017.
Nice.
And I know a lot of times, we're supposed to come up with puzzle pieces that inspired the movie. And a lot of times that's films that have similar themes. But this, I think, is a more practical way that they inspired this, because The Mummy cost, $150 million or something crazy like that. One of the biggest stars in the world. Everybody hated it. Like, the Dark Universe, after that one promo photo crumbled, it's like a meme now on film Twitter.
Yeah.
We're like, hey, Dark Universe coming soon? Question mark. So the fact that they went completely in the other direction and they got, they got Lee Whannell to make this movie for $7 million, like super bare bones, to the point that it's quadrupled its budget already just in the US in its first weekend, is insane to me. And I think it's very, I think it's a testament to, and this is not new information, but to the fact that horror really isn't contingent on a giant budget. And I think
Sure.
the fact that this movie also used closer to the horror roots of these characters, as opposed to trying to make it a Marvel style action adventure with like a gray, there was even an organization, which I can't remember the name of, in The Mummy that was like the Shield, that was led by Dr. Jekyll. And it was such a like ham-fisted approach to, you're going to watch this and you're going to like it with that property. And to see them completely flipping on its head here, I think was really satisfying and legitimately terrifying, as I'm sure we'll talk about.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And yeah, you're so right. I mean, it was going to be on my list as well, this Mummy reboot, launching of the Dark Universe. It's definitely an attempt to course correct. And it'll be interesting to see with the success of this if, sometimes Hollywood doesn't learn the right lessons from successes.
Right.
And it'll be interesting if they say, oh, okay, well, we got it now. Let's start that whole thing back up. Or if they maybe just greenlight a string of interesting but doesn't have to be connected takes on some of these characters, which is, pretty clearly the direction that they should be taking with all of this.
Yeah, and if they keep it with Blumhouse, I think their most expensive movie was Glass, which was like $20 million. So mm-hmm. they'll, they can keep that reined in a little bit and worry about connecting it all later if they decide to do that down the line.
Absolutely. I think, before jumping in my first piece, we should mention that, the Blumhouse connection. I mean, they really are... it's crazy. Their track record, they're all over the place, really. I mean, some of their things just, kind of don't do anything, but then some of them just make a shitload of money off of very, very little. And it's an interesting approach. It's a kind of just try everything as long as the budgets don't go too big. And so far they're really making a name for themselves when it comes to these kinds of movies. And I'm curious to see where it continues. I'm, you know, I, I joke around that I always say I'm not the biggest horror fan in the world, but it's like, I definitely appreciate the approach that they're taking when it comes to these things, not going and blowing things out of proportion, not trying to make these big, giant, epic versions of horror movies. They're just really making stories that, you know, at least on paper, you know, time after time are going to be interesting stories. And then, you know, whether or not they succeed, that's, you know, always up to the opening weekend and seeing what actually happens. But they are a very interesting studio.
Yeah, for sure. So what about you? What's your first piece?
So I will go with the first thing that I thought of, which was Terminator, Terminator 2, just the Terminator series in general. You know, Linda Hamilton's Sarah Connor is so sure of what she has seen, this thing that everybody thinks she's so crazy. And, you know, it's really a, you know, we never really thought of it, I don't think, at least I didn't, as a gaslighting kind of story. But right, I mean, Basically, everybody is convinced and trying to make sure she thinks that she's crazy as well. We also, of course, in Terminator 2, get the whole, you know, mental institution escape scene, which is, you know, huge and action-packed and violent, which that's where we get our biggest action sequence in this movie. But Elizabeth Moss does a great job of kicking some ass and you know, continuing that tradition of the badass chick who she knows she's not crazy and she's going to do whatever the hell it is that she has to do to prove it. And she's awesome, as she always is in this, but it's definitely a theme that I think is explored in both of these series.
Yeah. And I think too, if you look at the first two Terminators along with this movie and another one of my puzzle pieces that I'll mention in a little bit, I think you do see a sort of evolution of that character into being very submissive, very kind of meek, and then sort of an empowerment over the course of the story, where they really kind of take over the narrative in a powerful way, which you wouldn't expect automatically from the way that the stories start, I guess.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It's I'm really glad that he took this direction, you know, of telling the story from, you know, from the survivor's point of view, and not it being just all about the monster the whole time. It definitely opens it up to a much more interesting story than just being about the monster the whole time.
Right. And the way that the movie opens up too, with that situation where she's running away and you don't know exactly the details of it, but you're just kind of in it from the very beginning, I think that's a testament to the strength of the performances and the filmmaking. And that also leads directly into my second piece, actually.
Beautiful. Let's go
for it. So, the beginning of this movie, she's in a abusive relationship. She's looking for a way out. She's trying to escape. And in the first thing that popped into my head, and this is, I guess, because my mom actually really liked this movie when I was a kid, so it was on a lot, is 1991's Sleeping with the Enemy, which was starred Julia Roberts. And she's basically is a young woman trapped in an abusive, like, controlling relationship, a marriage, actually. And she fakes her own death and moves to another town to try and start a new life. And spoilers, her husband reappears, and it leads to a big showdown. And it's Sleeping with the Enemy felt very similar to The Invisible Man, minus all the invisibility stuff. So obviously, they diverge a lot. But the general premise of that kind of dynamic, that kind of relationship, I mean, now the Invisible Man has the benefit, if you can call it that, in air quotes, benefit of being super timely to the Me Too movement and everything going on, and gaslighting and everything that's been in the news so much the last few years. But Sleeping with the Enemy, I feel like, tapped into sort of like what you were saying, that victim's perspective of trying to get away from this controlling significant other, who in that case happened to be married. But that's what really, from the very first sequence where she's running out of the house and you know, trying to get a ride and get out of there. And in The Invisible Man, it's flipped that he fakes his death. But again, it's very similar elements, just kind of remixed with a sci-fi horror sheen on top.
I like that. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that movie in forever, but that is
it was
a very
one of those like TBS, TNT movies back in the 90s that I feel like it was constantly on television.
Yeah, Yeah, absolutely. That's just one of those movies that you just, you know, you could kind of picture the artwork, you know, and it's like, it's just something that you've seen a million times over the years, but maybe you haven't actually like thought about it or watched it.
Right. Forever. Exactly.
Well, I'm going to go for my next piece with kind of another angle that I looked like also at the opening with, and that is actually Ex Machina. The Alex Garland film, which I kind of looked at that whole opening as like this crazy tech, you know, genius billionaire house, you know, and it just filled with like so much technology, and the person who lives there is just, you know, there's just, you know, not something right with them. You don't know quite what exactly, and his control over anything, anyone who's in that house is, you know, not healthy. Let's put it that way.
Right.
and so, yeah, I just thought of Ex Machina and the Oscar Isaac character as, you know, being a little bit of a parallel to what's going on there. And we don't really dive too deep into the tech elements, you know, just, you know, we get some glimpses of, you know, how the suit is made and stuff like that. But it's all there, though. You can tell that the house is just so, you know, so souped up, high tech, you know, crazy futuristic. And it's also very secluded and away from, you know, the rest of the world by very much by design, not just rich guy house, but also, right, you know, because he's a sick fuck. So
I caught on with a little of that, like when I was watching it. Actually, I think Ex Machina even entered my mind a couple times because it's so centered on this, yeah, this house that's like very lots of natural light, all the glass, and the secretive project kind of happening in like a back room sort of deal. Yeah, it was a lot of that kind of vibe for sure.
Absolutely. So what do you got for your next piece?
All right. So I actually don't know how this happened. I have another 1991 thriller. Nice. The Silence of the Lambs. Noticed in this movie particularly, you know, she's very dominated by a man, even when she moves in with her sister's friend, Aldous Hodges, I think this gentleman's last name, the one from, Straight Outta Compton. You know, there's constant male presence, and she doesn't really get full power until the end. And I found a lot of thematic similarities between that story and that of Clarice Starling in that film, clearly being kind of a woman in a man's world. That was the whole idea there. There's even the sequence towards the end of Silence of the Lambs where Buffalo Bill has the night vision goggles on and is sort of sneaking up on her, Invisible Man style. She can't see anything around her. So there was a lot of, I wouldn't say that the movie next necessarily homages it, but I definitely think you can see the inspiration of that movie in Lee Whannell's work here a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, I could totally picture that, just on a, you know, just literal sense of an inspiration. I'm sure Lee Whannell is just so inspired by Silence of the Lambs, and, you know, I know that it's his film, but just Blumhouse in general, just the idea of horror films as something that can transcend, you know, and become something that's so culturally important.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I will go with another piece. So this one I could have just tied to that last piece, the Ex Machina piece, but I figured I'd just bring it up separately. And this one is really just something about the score. You know, I'm a musician, and so I love, you know, music and films. And a lot of the music is, you know, just straight up, you know, orchestral, just beautiful stuff. But then when shit gets, you know, gets weird and dark, it gets really strange sound designy, and it reminded me a little bit of the score from Alex Garland's Annihilation, from the whole last 30 minutes of that, where the score just goes bonkers. And I loved a lot of what they were doing with that. I love especially the juxtaposition between that beautiful, more traditional score versus that kind of stuff that just really throws you on edge. And it's again more so just the score, not so much anything with the film, although, you know, there's definitely a feminist angle to Annihilation, so you can draw some kind of comparison there. But so Annihilation, my next piece.
Yeah, I need to go back and listen to the Annihilation score, because I do remember seeing that film and enjoying it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But I haven't really gotten a chance to go back and listen to that. I do want to point out, though, the score from Invisible Man was outstanding. Like, I've been listening to it the last couple of days on Spotify while I'm writing articles and things like that. And
nice.
It's Benjamin Wallfisk, who did the scores for It and It Chapter 2, Blade Runner 2049. Like, he's been killing it the last few years. So people that are into film scores should go and check that one out, because it's really intense. The denouement track in particular, which I noticed during the movie, like as the denouement is happening and the kind of leading into the credits, and you know, we're not going to get into the ending per se right now, but just a really powerful combination of visuals and music. It's beautifully done.
Totally. So what do you got next?
All right. So this didn't really pop into my head until late in the movie. She is been framed for all these crimes. She's locked up. She's given a sort of last ditch effort to free herself and to get her life back. And then she's momentarily trapped in this toxic relationship. And I've read interviews with Lee Whannell that he even thought of this film and kind of was inspired by it. So I'm talking about 2014's Gone Girl. Big in this movie. Big toxic, you know. And I think that's what's interesting about this film is that as opposed to Gone Girl, it's kind of like the gender roles are flipped. Like in that film, Amy is the one holding all the power and Nick is just kind of stuck with limited options. Although I think the difference there being in Gone Girl, you're not like Nick's kind of a dick also. So you're not really on his side as much. Sure. You know what I mean? More than Amy. But in this movie, this whole point is to put you 100% in the shoes of Cecilia. And I think that's where they diverge. But there's definitely a lot of thematic similarities compared to that Fincher film.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great one. I hadn't thought of that. And that's interesting that Lee Whannell had specifically cited that as well, because that definitely makes sense now that I, you know, hear it out loud and think of it. That totally makes sense. Yeah, I love it. So I'm going to go with another one that kind of ties back to the score a little bit. And it's the lack of score. It's the really quiet parts of the film. And I thought of as a combination of both A Quiet Place, which we got the sequel coming out in a couple of weeks here, and Don't Breathe, both movies that really are very, very deliberate in their use of keeping things quiet to where you could just hear the pin drop and to where it really amps up the tension of, like, you know that something bad is either going to happen or is already happening and you just maybe don't even notice it yet. And it's got you just kind of, it really puts your senses kind of on alert as you're watching the film. And lots of shots of just the room, and you don't even know, like, oh, is something happening in this room right now? Why am I watching this so intently?
You know? I noticed that too in the cinematography in The Invisible Man. Like, you're a lot of times down a hallway, kind of creepy. Like, so it's very voyeuristic in the way that the movie's presented too, which I thought was great.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so it really just helps to put you on edge the whole time. And I think that's one of the things that makes the movie, work so well, is just that it's that combination of cinematography. There's probably some like invisible production design in there that you just not even really realizing it, but it's just the room is probably laid out in such a way that like, it's just your eyes don't know where to go exactly. And then since the sound isn't giving you any clues, the music isn't giving you any clues, it really just helps or like lose you in there, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I did take notice of that for a lot.
Yeah.
And I do love Don't Breathe, by the way, for people who haven't seen that movie, which I mean, it was a decent sized hit and we've heard rumors of a sequel or supposed to move forward, but definitely I feel like it was very vastly underrated when that came out, because it also has very meticulous, as you were kind of alluding, sound design and a great performance by Jane Levy. So.
And a great dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like Zeus in this one.
No, funny thing. I was leaving the house the other night to go see The Invisible Man. And my daughter's like, are you going to see a movie? I'm like, yeah, not for you. She's like, is there a dog in it? I'm like, I will let you know. I mean, and then the opening scene, Zeus showed up. I was like, she was right. There was a dog in it. Kid's a genius.
It's a good dog. All right. What do you got for your next piece?
Well, throughout the movie, you know, we're really kind of wondering, is Cecilia, I mean, you know, it's called The Invisible Man, and we're assuming that there's going to be an invisible man at some point, but for the first half, it's very much like, is she going crazy? Is she imagining things? It's kind of that unreliable narrator vibe. Sure. And I was getting big Black Swan vibes, just with the level of performance, with sort of the people around you. You're not sure what to believe. And then you kind of find yourself put in, I think it really clicked for me when, spoilers, obviously, the scene in the restaurant with her sister.
Yeah.
When the knife just comes across and it's back in her hand. And obviously we saw it float, but she doesn't. So it's sort of like that doubting your own sanity. Like, is Adrian dead? Is he the monster? Am I that whole sort of psychological breakdown that you witness in Black Swan, I think really came through here. Plus in that movie, it's heavily implied that she's in an abusive relationship with her mother. So, and I think there's another angle in which these two movies have that, that kind of common ground.
Yeah, I think that that's a great connection there. And, you know, just to the point, I saw Lee Winnell said something about, you know, how it was important not to show you, you know, exactly what happened so that you just kind of have to believe her, you know? And I think that's such a smart way to approach it, especially, you know, to tie into the whole timely Me Too and everything like that. And, you know, just, you know, you gotta believe her that this shit is happening. And then, you know, sure enough, it is. I mean, there is an invisible man in the movie, but, and he is insane. But yeah, I love that scene though. That scene in the restaurant with the sister. I mean, that was just fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I want to also real fast before we get to your next piece, I want to circle back around to what we were saying about believing Cecilia, that in the end of the movie, I feel like the film does try and kind of bring that back around, where when she kills Adrian, that you don't like, and I really respect Lee Winnell for doing this. I think that 100% we're supposed to believe that, you know, that Adrian was behind this, that it was all gaslighting and it's all a big ruse that he put together from the beginning. But the movie never confirms it for you. And I love that about it. Like there's always that little tiny, like 5% seed of doubt. But did he? Like what's happened? Like, I think it's the movie is on Cecilia's side, but the fact that it doesn't clarify it there and doesn't have him say, you know, say something menacing right before, as he's like gurgling in his last breaths. I really love that about it. And I feel like if they do make a sequel to this, I feel like that is a thread that they can pick up on, that Cecilia can kind of be haunting her, that she never 100% got that closure. If they wanted to go that route, I don't know if that would, if at all, tarnish the impact of this ending, or if it would just be an extension of it. But that's just something I wanted to make sure I mentioned, because I really thought that was a lovely touch.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. So I will go with my next piece, and I've only got two more at this point, but my next one though. So this, first of all, speak of that ending, you get that close in shot on Cecilia staring out at the camera. I immediately was like, oh my God, they're ending it exactly like every episode of The Handmaid's Tale, which of course has Elizabeth Moss stuck in this awful society where she's getting, you know, treated just as absolutely horribly as could possibly be. And then at the end of every episode, she is possibly getting out of the situation and staring at the camera intently, just really intense. And that's every episode. And so I just totally thought that, like, oh wow, they're going to end it just like that. So that's,
well, they got Elizabeth Moss right there. She's an expert at that at this point. So
yeah,
might as well.
That's her thing. I feel like, we need to end every Elizabeth Moss movie that way.
There you go.
Yeah. It's
we have spoken.
Thing. So what do you got next?
So I think just in the way they approach this character, the way the film is technically a remake, reboot, whatever you want to call it, of the 1933 movie, but it's also kind of not at all. I really thought of, and this is a super recent film, but I really thought of Joker, and the fact that Joker is a movie about the Joker, but if you change a few details, it's not really about the Joker at all. And I feel like this is another example of a film that's lower budgeted, that's more character focused, that, you know, is trying to say something about society, about relationships, about whatever, you know, mental health in both films actually and stuff. And sort of borrows an established IP in order to get people to go to the theater, to get that message out there. And I think it's all, you know, touching back to what I said before about the way that this movie ends, it is sort of open to interpretation. Like, you know, where does she go from here? Where does Arthur go at the end of Joker? Are both of those are probably going to get sequels, but we have no idea what they're going to look like.
Sure.
So I think just the way that they take this you know, ongoing property and reinvent it, recontextualize it, and repackage it in such a completely different way. It just felt to me like and obviously the Invisible Man was in production before Joker, but like, I wonder how many more now with these two movies, how many more projects we're going to see like that, where it's, you know, it's a character or a brand that we know, but not really recognizable in almost any way, shape or form.
I love that. That's a really great piece. I think that's a great, great comparison. And I also think if they were ever going to try to make a female Joker movie, Elizabeth Moss would be a great candidate for that.
She would, actually. Isn't it in some of the
eyebrows?
Flashpoint, I think, in the comics, I think that Martha Wayne becomes the Joker. And
I don't know.
Thomas Wayne, yeah. Yeah, I've seen the animated film, and I think I went back and read it eventually. But yeah, so in that, Thomas Wayne is the Batman because Bruce gets killed, and then Martha Wayne becomes the Joker. So there you go. WB, if you decide to do that, you know who to call, Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah,
just make sure she looks out at the camera at the end, and we're good.
That's exactly how it has to end every single time. And then we don't know if she's crazy or not.
Right.
So for my last piece, I am going to go with, now this is a little bit silly, but you know, we've talked about how there's the original Invisible Man, and then the so many things that have come since it that are, you know, just inspired by it, or remakes of it, or loose remakes of it. And I just wanted to mention Hollow Man, because I
was hoping somebody would. It was going to be you or me.
I mean, I understand this movie gets a really bad rep. But I want to say 15 when it came out, maybe. And I thought it freaking ruled at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. I haven't seen it since I was a teenager. But I have very fond memories of that movie. And I think, you know, even though this movie definitely wasn't going all in on the action, there's some, you know, action sequences and whatnot that are done really well. I mean, Lee Winnell, especially Upgrade, I loved Upgrade.
Yeah, I did too.
He really can stage some really cool action sequences, and he does them here too. But, you know, Hollow Man really took that concept of this invisible man and just really made a really fun action film out of it. And so I definitely think that there is a little bit of a nod to that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that was also a kind of blatant example of how can we do the Invisible Man in, you know, well, that was 2000, but like in a modern context, not a period piece or anything.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. Let's do it and update it and, you know, see how it would work now.
Right.
So, all right. Well, you got any other pieces?
I did think of Evil Dead 2, just because those scenes when she's by herself and she thinks she might be hallucinating or things like that. I noticed that in Evil Dead 2, that's kind of a running thing throughout the Evil Dead trilogy, that Ash, like the crazy stuff tends to happen when no one's around. And obviously in this movie, it's by design. Just that kind of stylistic choice made me think of Evil Dead. And then also we have a sort of a tech billionaire or a millionaire, whatever he is, in a really cool house, like on a hill with lots of glass near, like, I think it's even near water in this movie, who's building these suits. So I thought of Iron Man 3, just because he's got these state-of-the-art suits and all of that. And yeah, and his kind of need for it to survive, I guess, in both cases as well.
I just have to thank you for being the one to bring up Evil Dead, because everybody yells at me when I bring up Evil Dead way too much on this show. But I actually had thought of that in the theater and forgot to write it down, because especially when she's breaking the pots on him, and it's, you know, it's Ash breaking all the glasses on himself during the scene with the hand. Love it.
Obviously here it's not for comedic effect, but it's still, there's still, you know, very similar, similar style. And I think it plays into the whole unreliable narrator part of this. Is like, well, we only see what she thinks is happening, possibly. And
exactly.
I think, yeah, good call. I'm glad we were on the same page with that.
I love it. All right, cool. Well, I'm going to do the finished puzzle, and then we will get into any closing thoughts we had on The Invisible Man. So we have got The Mummy, that's, of course, the recent remake with the Dark Universe, The Terminator series, Sleeping with the Enemy, Ex Machina, The Silence of the Lambs, Annihilation, Gone Girl, A Quiet Place, Don't Breathe, Black Swan, The Handmaid's Tale, Joker, Hollow Man, Evil Dead 2, and Iron Man 3.
It's a good list of movies, too.
Yeah, it sure is. A lot of really good stuff. There seems to be like a lot of high-techie stuff in there.
Yeah.
I think so. But no, definitely a great list of movies. Do you have any other thoughts that you wanted to mention about this one?
I think this... I actually, you know, was looking forward to this movie, and I was hoping it would be good, but I think it was actually better than I thought it would be. Like, it exceeded my expectations, and I think... if we're going to do these classic monster movies in a modern context, I think this is probably as good of an Invisible Man movie as you're going to get without it falling into the same trap of being really hokey or feeling very dated or things like that. And, you know, find a social context for it. Underneath all of these characters, there's something very sort of primal about them that I think makes them terrifying and has helped them endure. And I think, you know, dealing with fighting an unseen force and, well, how is that relevant today? Having it be sort of a commentary on, you know, dealing with trauma, dealing with abuse, and dealing with the aftermath of that, literally fighting an unseen demon. I thought that was a really smart way to bring this brand back. And I love this as a self-contained story, I kind of do want to see what Lee Winnell does with a sequel, or, you know, maybe have this same team, not necessarily the stars, but like have the same cinematographer and Lee Winnell and Jason Blum, have them just kind of continue to tackle the different Universal monsters that way.
Yeah.
I have a kind of a mental running list of really strong horror filmmakers. You know, like the Ari Asters, the Jordan Peels, the Robert Eggers, and people like that. And I think after this one, I'm officially adding Lee Winnell to that list, because this is probably as good as a horror movie as we've seen. Like, it's up in the conversation with some of the best we've seen in the last few years, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it's interesting. He's an interesting filmmaker because he brings in so many aspects. Like I said earlier, his action sequences are fantastic when he pulls them out. And, you know, he definitely has a command of horror as well. I mean, he's a very kind of unpredictable filmmaker when you look at his filmography. I mean, I don't like the Insidious movies, but other than that, I really like a lot of what he's done. And he's very interesting. I'm looking forward to what he does, and I do hope that the takeaway is more so to maybe let him, you know, spearhead another monster or something like that versus a sequel. But I mean, I guess we'll see what happens, and I'm looking forward to it, whatever it ends up being. I put it that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that does it. I think we covered The Invisible Man here. Do you have another movie you watched recently you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, so just on a personal note, this Valentine's Day that just passed, 2020, was actually, I'd been with my wife for 9 years. So
nice.
Thank you. Well, like, I mean, we'd been dating for 9 years, but together 9 years. So we actually ended up watching Before Sunset, and that led into, which I coincidentally, those movies take place every 9 years, the trilogy. Mm-hmm. So I actually, after that, we watched the whole trilogy. She had never seen it. So I went back and then finally bit the bullet and got the Criterion Collection Before Trilogy box set on Blu-ray. And these movies just every time, I mean, it's only the second time I've seen them, but they are such... they have such kind of profound commentary on time and relationships, and it's very meditative and romantic, but also, you know, as they go along, like realistically romantic. Like in the third movie, it's not nearly as, you know, as cut and dried as the young love of the first one. It's much more complex, and you know, that's, I don't know if, I'm assuming you've seen these films at some point.
Oh yeah, they're fantastic. I've only seen each one once, but yeah, they're really amazing movies.
Yeah, so being able to watch them again now, having been in a relationship for just about as long as it takes between the first and second movie, and the second and third movie, I think it adds a whole new resonance for me. So if people haven't seen those somehow, definitely check those out. And if you have seen them, I would recommend getting the Blu-ray set. I think it's the only box set you can get with the three of them actually in the same collection. So I would definitely keep an eye out for next time Criterion has a flash sale or something and pick those up because they're outstanding.
Great recommendation right there. Hey, this has been great, Robert. Why don't you tell people where they can find your podcast?
Yeah, you can find new episodes of the Crooked Table podcast at crookedtable.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at Crooked Table. I'm also on, Instagram, and we have a Facebook page and all that stuff. So just crookedtable.com, and we have a contact page where you can see all the different places where we have social media presence.
Sweet. Well, hey, thank you so much for being here. I'm glad to finally get you on, and hopefully we could do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Anytime. Just let me know.
Warning, do not listen while hungry.
Hi, my name is Stephanie Barajas, host of All Rice, No Beans, a podcast all about restaurants and the people behind some of your favorite spots to eat, where we talk about how they started, all the ups and downs, and my favorite part, the food and drinks. Ooh, and let's not forget about the desserts. So subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, follow me on all social media, because I have the pictures of all the food. And if you want to be on my podcast and you're a restaurant owner or in the business, email me at allricenobeanspodcast@gmail.com. And remember, you were warned. Don't listen while hungry.
All right. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation about The Invisible Man. It is, of course, still out in theaters. Just came out this past weekend, and it's doing good. I'm sure, like we talked about in that conversation, we're going to be seeing some kind of follow-up from Blumhouse and Lee Whannell. Hopefully they learn the right lessons from this and take it in the right direction. But we'll see what happens. But anyway, we're going to be here to cover it as we continue piecing it together. Year 3 kicking off now. If you're enjoying the show, we would love it if you'd rate and review us over on Apple Podcasts and Podchaser. 5 stars would be amazing. But we do want to know what you're thinking of the show, how you like the format, how you like the guests, how you like what we do here with the puzzle pieces, and how do you like the new music? How do you like the new artwork? How do you like everything that I'm doing here on the show? I'd really love to hear from you. So rate and review us. You could also just contact me. Get in touch on social media at PiecingPod. Email me directly, bydavidrosen@gmail.com. That's my email address. Get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. And if you'd like to be on Piecing It Together, I'd especially love to hear from you. So get in touch, everybody. So I think it is time to leave you guys with a piece of music. And I don't think there's any better choice. Originally I was going to play a piece of music from this new project I'm about to release, but I guess I'll tell you about that next week. But I actually have a song from one of my albums. The song's called Invisible, and I can't think of a better track to play than Invisible on an episode about The Invisible Man. So let's play Invisible. It's from my last album, A Different Kind of Dream. And there is a music video that I have written for this. I have like a whole script, and I'm hoping to one day make it. It's going to cost a little bit of money, though, so who knows when that's going to happen. But if I can make it happen one day, if I have a few grand in just disposable income that I want to spend for no good reason, maybe I will spend it to produce this video, because I think it would be really freaking cool. But we'll see if that ever happens. But there is new music on the way. That's a little bit of a tease. You can go search for Music by David Rosen on Facebook and get a little inside scoop as to what that's all about, because there is new music coming your way soon, and I'll have a lot of tracks to filter into these ending segments of the show in the coming months from that new album. But for now, let's go to the last album. Again, it's called A Different Kind of Dream. It's available anywhere music is available, and the song is Invisible.
And all points west.